the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Okay, so we're going to look at the second set of Beatitudes tonight, and I want to read just a few verses more before we do that. And this is from Psalm 37 in the Old Testament. And of course, biblical scholars like yourselves don't need to know this, but it's on page 541. And I just want to read the first few verses of Psalm 37, because as you'll see as we read it, it has a lot to say to the two bits of Matthew we're talking about tonight. Here we go. Psalm 37, a psalm of David. Do not fret because of those who are evil, or be envious of those who do wrong. For like the grass, they will soon wither. Like green plants, they will soon die away. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. Take delight in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord, trust in him, and he will do this. He'll make your righteous reward shine like the dawn, your vindication like the noonday sun. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when people succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret, it leads only to evil. For those who are evil will be destroyed, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. And it's the same word as the word for earth in Matthew. So clearly this is the passage that lies behind what Jesus was saying when he said, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And it's important that we keep that context there. Well, now, Nick started off the series last week and did a great job with it. And one of the things that he wrote, I think in the speaker brief, I don't think he actually said this last week, was that in all of the Beatitudes, you find the same three-part thing going on. First of all, there's a blessing. Blessed are. And Jesus picks out people whom he thinks are specially blessed. What does that word mean? Nick explained it a bit last week. It doesn't just mean happy. Because in English, our word happy comes from the word hap, which means chance. And it's not just that these people are fortunate. You know, things have happened by sheer luck to work out for them. And it's a feeling all the time. Happy tends to talk about the way we feel about our circumstances. You can be blessed without being full of happiness all the time. Jesus says, blessed are those who mourn, for example. So instead, he's talking about people who are in a special kind of a state that's blessed by God. And the blessing is the first thing. The second thing that happens is the beatitude, if you like, to use the phrase that we've used, in the middle of the whole thing. Who are these people? What kind of people are we talking about? And Jesus picks out eight in the whole series. And finally, he gives a promise to each of them as well. So, for example, in the one that we're looking at tonight, or the first of them, it would go like this. The blessing is, blessed are. And then Jesus says, who? The meek. And then there's a promise, for they shall inherit the earth. So we've got two tonight. What are we looking at? And Nick has called them blessed to be pressurized. Last week it was blessed to be poor. Those who are poor and those who are mourning are specially blessed. And tonight it's those who are meek and those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Those who live under special pressure in the world because they're trying to copy a style and live out a pattern of living, a lifestyle that the world just doesn't get. And because of that, they're under pressure a lot of the time. And Jesus says, despite that, despite the fact it can be a hard way to live, it's the only way to live, and it's the blessed way to live. So the two we've got, blessed are the meek, they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. We're just going to unpack those two over the next few minutes. First, a couple of stories. Back in 1955, when this picture was taken, the girl here was just a normal black person working in an office in a city in the southern states of America. And she became very, very famous because of something she did. If you look at Martin Luther King in the background there, you probably work out what it was. This is Rosa Parks. She's a lady who went on the bus and refused to give up her seat on a segregated bus to a white person because she was supposed to do that as somebody who is black and therefore second rate. And there she is going to court in 1956, in February 1956. Very brave lady, just sitting there, not budging, standing up against a law that she believed to be unjust. And we know a lot about Rosa Parks and the kind of things she's famous for. She said lots of things after that. You must never be fearful, she said, about what you're doing when it is right. It doesn't matter if people oppose you. It doesn't matter if people think little of you. Carry on doing it if it's right. One thing that not many people realize about her, though, is that Rosa Parks was a very, very devout and very biblical Christian. That's her Gideon Bible that she carried around everywhere with her. It's now in a museum collection in America. And she said every day when she was growing up, before supper and before we went to services on Sundays, my grandmother would read the Bible to me. My grandfather would pray. We even had devotions before going to pick cotton in the fields. Prayer and the Bible became a part of my everyday thoughts and beliefs. I learned to put my trust in God and to seek him as my strength. Fantastic. And she said, from my upbringing and the Bible, I learned people should stand up for rights, just as the children of Israel stood up to Pharaoh. 12 years before that happened, middle of the Second World War, in Munich in Germany, sheets like this one that you see there started being left around furtively around the University of Munich. And they were written by a bunch of anonymous students who wanted Germans to realize what was going on in the war, the horrible things that were happening to Jews, the concentration camps, and the fact that they were winning. They were losing the moral ground as well as the battles of the war. And the first leaflet said, for instance, this: who among us can imagine all the shame that will come to us and our children one day when the veil has fallen from our eyes and our most horrible, immeasurable crimes reach the light of day? It was written by a bunch of young Christians. Hans Scholl, who was the leader of the group, third-year student, a medical student, said this: the communists are doing everything they can to oppose what Hitler's up to. Where are the Christians? It's high time that Christians made up their minds to do something. What are we going to show in the way of resistance as compared to the communists? For instance, when all this terror is over, we'll be standing empty-handed. We will have no answer when we're asked, what did you do about it? And so just to protest, just to do something, he started issuing those anonymous leaflets. His little sister, Sophie, a first-year student, and all but engaged to a captain in the German army, as you can see here, shared his opinions, and when she found out about them, wanted to join the group. And he all said, no, it's far too dangerous for a girl. But she joined anyway, and the White Rose Group, as they were called, started distributing leaflets more and more widely. The night came in February 1943 when, just as lectures were coming to an end in the lecture rooms that you see in the back there and all around this hall, the Lichthalle in the university, Sophie and her brother went in and started to put piles of leaflets around where people could find them. And just as they left, they were spotted. They were arrested. Less than 48 hours after that, they were hustled through a trial and killed. And the bravery with which they went to their deaths shows how serious their intention was in what they did. This is Sophie, the picture taken of her as she was taken into captivity just after she was arrested. And she said this in her trial. She wasn't allowed to speak for herself, but there were several outbursts where she wouldn't be kept quiet. And this is one of her outbursts. Somebody, after all, had to make a start. What we wrote and said is also believed by many others. They just don't dare to express themselves as we did. You know the war is lost. Why don't you have the courage to face it? And when it came to the morning of her execution, she wrote this just before she was taken off. Just such a fine sunny day, and I have to go. But what does my death matter if through us thousands of people are awakened and stirred to action? Christoph Probst was another member of the group, and he was tried and executed on the same morning. And he said this: I didn't know that dying could be so easy. In a few minutes, he said to the rest of the group, we will meet in eternity. And so they went to their desk, convinced that what they were doing was absolutely right and had to be done. And one of her executioners, a Gestapo member, said afterwards, she went without a flicker of an eyelash. None of us understood how this was possible. The executioner said he had never seen anyone meet his end as she did. And the last words she said before finally she was guillotined were this: God, you are my refuge into eternity. Isn't it fantastic? When being a Christian makes you stand up for what you believe to be right like that. And I start with those two stories because so often this beatitude about blessed are the meek has been taken to mean blessed are those who are inoffensive. Blessed are those who are submissive. Blessed are those who don't answer back. Blessed are those who keep their heads down and just get on with it and pay their taxes and don't say boo to a goose. That is not what blessed are the meek is about. But it's been sent up many, many times. The meek shall inherit the earth, but they'll never increase market share. The meek shall inherit the earth, but not the mineral rights. That was Paul Getty. It tells you an awful lot about him, that. And my preference of the lot, the meek shall inherit the earth if that's all right with everyone else. But that's not what meek means. We tend to make meek mean mild. Leslie Weatherhead, the Methodist preacher, says in one of his books, you know, maybe it's because mild is such a good rhyme when you write a hymn. You know, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, pity me, a little child. And so we use mild a lot because it rhymes with child and wild and other things that we like to use. But then he says, well, hang on a minute, it's not always like that. Think about Christmas carols. How about once in Royal David City? Christian children all must be mild, obedient, good as he. Goodness, it's getting in even when there's no need for a rhyme. What is going on here? And so meek and mild are often thought to mean the same thing, but they're certainly not. If you think about Jesus, he's an example of meekness, and the New Testament makes that point several times. But he's not mild. The things he says to people are sometimes downright offensive. The things he does gets him into trouble again and again, and he walks clear-eyed into those situations. He's not mild, but he's meek. And the Greek word that's used for meek in the New Testament is a million miles away from meaning somebody who just says, yes, dear, no, never mind whatever you say, I will just do whatever you want. It's not that kind of situation at all. The word prais in Greek is the word that the Greeks regularly used for a tamed horse. They would take stallions down from the hillside because wild horses made the best war horses and trained them and break them in for months until they were trained so well it was said that a horse could gallop into battle at 35 miles an hour and at one word of command from the rider would just stop dead. It was that obedient. And that was meekness. Tamed. William Barclay says somewhere, the Bible commentator, that the word was used, and I can't prove this, but it's a great picture, of a caged lion. And if that's the case, that describes exactly what a Christian's supposed to be. Not somebody who's lost all of his or her natural passions and enthusiasms, who's now living a colorless life of Bible reading and prayer meetings and digestive biscuits at 9 o'clock at night before you go for an early bed are the most exciting thing that happens to you in the week. It's not that way at all. A Christian is somebody who's like a caged lion. All the passions, all the red-blooded nature is still there, but it's under control. That's what meek means. Not somebody who's had the life steamed out of him or her, but somebody who's got it all there, just under control. And as we've seen already, Psalm 37 lies at the back of this. And if you look at Psalm 37, the description of people that it gives you there, the kind of people who are blessed, you understand what being meek means a little bit more. Do you remember these verses? Commit your way to the Lord, trust in him, and he will act. He will bring forth your vindication as the light and your right as the noonday. Be still before the Lord. Wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself over him who prospers in the way, over the man who carries out evil devices. Refrain from anger, forsake wrath. Fret not yourself. It tends only to evil. In other words, don't try to do it yourself. Don't try to go your own way. Allow God to be in charge of the situation. Submit yourself to him and allow him to be the cage around the lion. So the question you then have to ask is, how does this be attitude follow on from the first two that we looked at last week? Well, this is the way that Tom Wright translates it, and Nick read this out last week. Wonderful news for the poor in spirit, the kingdom of heaven is yours. Wonderful news for the mourners, you're going to be comforted. And Nick said, this is referring not just to people who are mourning about anything, but people who have recognized their own spiritual poverty. People who realize they can do nothing for themselves and are prepared to put their affairs, their future, the issues of their life right into the hands of God. Those are the people that Jesus says are blessed. And Nick also quoted this, if you remember, from Frederick Dale Bruner. God helps those who cannot help themselves, and he also helps those who try to help others. But he does not in any beatitude help those who think they can help themselves. That's the opposite of meekness, you see. Meekness means realizing you can't help yourself and saying, God, you've got to do it. I'm going your way. I'm leaning on your wisdom. It may seem crazy to me, but I'm going that way. Whatever you tell me to do, I will do it. And I'll just trust to you to take the consequences of whatever I'm doing. That is meekness, a life that's under the control of somebody who's bigger and wiser and knows more than the possessor of that life actually does. And I think there are at least three ways the New Testament tells us that we need to be meek. In fact, this word prize comes up, or priotes, the noun from it, comes up 16 times in the New Testament. And if you know anything about using Bible Hub and the Greek version of the scriptures that you find in there to find different references, and if you don't, you should, but anyhow, ask me about it afterwards. That's a great study to do. Those 16 references tell you an awful lot about meekness. One of the things it tells you is that we need to be meek in our dealings with ourselves. We need to judge ourselves in the right way. Keep ourselves under control. It's so easy to rationalize things, to justify ourselves, to make excuses for things we shouldn't make excuses for. And we need to be meek in our dealings with ourselves. Nobody, I guess, has written more about this particular beatitude than William Barclay, who was a great preacher, a fantastic scholar of Greek, and also a Scotsman. So, brilliant, obviously. But he wrote about the whole thing that if you want to get a complete understanding of what blessed are the meek is talking about, you've got to read it something like this. Oh, the bliss of the man who is always angry at the right time and never angry at the wrong time. Who has every instinct and impulse and passion under control because he himself is God-controlled. Who has the humility to realize his own ignorance and his own weakness. And Barclay ends up, for such a man is a king among men. And that's what inheriting the earth means, really, isn't it? Not just that one of these days we're going to see Jesus come back and we'll all be rewarded and I've got a mansion just over the hilltop, but that right now, with all of the persecutions there are in life, there is still the possibility to be a king among men, to enjoy life in a way that other people don't, just because your life is held securely and firmly in the hands of somebody that you know will never let you down. Do you remember when Peter came to Jesus and said, look, we've given up loads of things for your sake. What do we get back from it? And Jesus says, you'll get much, much more in this present life with persecutions. And then there's the world to come as well. That's being a king. That's what meekness brings with it. And James chapter 1 talks a little bit about the meekness we need to have with ourselves. My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. Yeah, that's easy to say. But how do you get like that, James? Well, get rid of all moral filth and the evil that is so prevalent. And that's easy, isn't it? Yeah. And here's the secret. Humbly, and the word means meekly, it's the same word, priotes. Humbly accept the word planted in you, which can save you. The word has been planted in you. You've become a Christian. Your eyes have been opened to Jesus and all that he's about. Well, receive that word with meekness. Allow it to control the forest fire of emotions that there is inside you. Allow it to sink down deep and become the controlling principle of your whole life. Humbly, meekly accept the word planted in you. Here's another passage where the word's used again, and this time it's translated gentleness in our English version. Paul says to Timothy, some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. But you, man of God, flee from all this. You're not interested in fame, popularity, money, whatever. That's a dead end. That's not going to lead anywhere. Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance. And how do you get to those things? And meekness, gentleness. Meekness in your dealings with yourself. But meekness also in your dealings with other people. I think there are at least four kinds of people that the New Testament talks about, and these are just examples, there are lots of others as well, that are important when it comes to being meek. First of all, we have to be meek with those who aren't Christians. When you're sharing your faith with somebody, Peter says, always be ready to give a reason for the hope that's in you. You should never be at a loss. You should always have something you can say. But don't come across sounding like a glib sort of answer machine. Don't sound as if you're superior. I remember taking somebody on the streets once to do a little bit of evangelism, and every time he was asked a question, he'd say, well, I think that's a really stupid answer. Daft objection. And you know, it just set up antipathy in the other person. Absolutely crazy. And Peter says, always be ready to give a reason for the hope that's in you, but do this with gentleness and respect. Let your meekness come across to the other person, and then you'll be able to win them. Second, there are those who are Christians, but they've gone wrong. What do you do with them? Judge them, condemn them, gossip about them. No, says Paul in Galatians chapter 6. He says, if someone is caught in a sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently. And again, it's translated gently, but it's our word, it's that word, meekly. As someone who's under control. As someone who realizes that in you is the same impulse to go make the same sort of devastation in your life if it weren't controlled. That way you give them hope. If they realize that you are the same as they are, but that there's somebody who's strong enough to keep you from doing the stupid stuff that they've been doing, then it gives some hope, doesn't it, for a return to reality and to Jesus. Third, there are those who are argumentative. And Paul says to Timothy, opponents must be gently, and you know what that word is by now, gently instructed in the hope that God will grant them repentance. Sometimes people can say the most inflammatory, horrible, awful things about you. You look at some of the Christian sites on the internet and you'll see what I'm talking about. There are more wars being fought there between people who are born-again Christians. It breaks your heart sometimes to read the things that people say about folks who have a different idea of the church or a different view of world prophecy or a different interpretation of certain scriptures, or, you know, they read the authorized version and nothing else, or they don't read the authorized version at all. Whatever it is, we've got great ways of fighting with one another over the things that should unite us. And Paul says, that's not right. Opponents must be instructed in the hope that God will grant them repentance. Do it gently, do it meekly. And with our marriage partners as well, I say this in great fear and trepidation with my wife sitting there because I'm not very good at it. But I just take courage from the fact that this is something that Peter said to wives, not husbands. So you're listening up here. And he said this, your beauty should come not from gold and broided hair and jewelry and stuff like that, but from the unfading beauty of a meek and quiet spirit. Meekness, self-control in our relationships with one another. I am not brave enough to pretend that that just applies to wives either, so you can tell me all about it afterwards. Okay, we need to be meek in our dealings with God as well. It's so easy, isn't it? Just to rebel, just to run away, just to exert our independence. One of the great English poets, I guess, is this guy, George Herbert, born in the 16th century, lived in the 17th, came from a wealthy family, well positioned to do really, really well in life, went off to Cambridge, did well there. Everybody expected him to go to court and make his fortune. He didn't. He became a country parson. And when he died a few years later, hardly anybody knew his name. But he left a package of poems behind, which people started reading and thinking, hey, this is not bad, this is great. And his poetry is spoken for centuries afterwards to people about the reality of a Christian experience. And it's not all straightforward stuff. Sometimes he talks about his arguments with God, and there's one particular poem which really struck me when I started looking at this whole thing about meekness. I thought, this, I've got to read a bit of this. So I'm sorry, you're going to get a poetry reading too. It's called The Collar. Now, we wouldn't get that, but in the 17th century, collar was not just something that you put around a dog's head to say, no, don't go, come on, and guide it in that way. Collar also meant anger. So God's trying to collar Herbert and keep him going in a certain way. And Herbert is responding with anger. Let me just, for my old university copy of The Collar, here we go. This is the poem. I struck the board and cried, no more, I will abroad. What, shall I ever sigh and pine? My lines and life are free. Free as the road, loose as the wind, as large as store. Shall I be still in suit? Have I no harvest but a thorn to let me blood and not restore what I've lost with cordial fruit? Sure, there was wine before my sighs did dry it. There was corn before my tears did drown it. Is the year only lost to me? Have I no bays to crown it? No flowers, no garlands, blay, all blasted, all wasted? Not so my heart, but there is fruit, and thou hast hands. Recover all thy sigh-blown age on double pleasures. Leave thy cold dispute of what is fit or not. Forsake thy cage, thy rope of sands, which petty thoughts have made, and made to thee good cable, to enforce and draw and be thy law, which thou didst, while thou didst wink and wouldst not see. Away, take heed, I will abroad. Call in thy death's head there, tie up thy fears. He that forbears to suit and serve his need deserves his load. But as I raved, and grew more fierce and wild at every word, methoughts I heard one calling, child? And I replied, my Lord. It's great, isn't it? It's like that sometimes. I can't stand this. I don't like these restrictions. I am not going to put up with this any longer. It's my life. I want to enjoy it. I want to do the same as everybody else. I want to have a good time. I'm just wasting my time here. And so we rebel. Then we hear the voice saying, child. And something in us says, my Lord. We come back. That's the start of meekness. We've got a second one, though, haven't we? We need to fill this one into in our remaining minutes. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. You see, if you are meek, if you are under the control of a power outside yourself, then you will start to want things that you never wanted before. You start to have visions of the way that things can be. You start to get excited about things that never excited you before. And one of those things is righteousness. In fact, that's the central thing. Righteousness, dikaiosune, the Greek word, just simply means everything being in harmony, everything being the way it should be. You start to look at the universe with God's eyes and think, I would love it to be the way that God wanted it to be. You start to see what he had planned at the start of creation and think, wow, that's what we really need. That's where we need to get to. How can I be an agent of righteousness? And it's important to notice, because Simon was talking about what you don't get in English grammar this morning, and suggesting that if you went to Glasgow, you get a better translation of it. I have a copy of the Gospel in Broad Scots, if you'd like it, actually. But anyway, I'll pass it on to you some other time. But this is another bit of grammar for you, I'm afraid. Do you remember this advert? Du pain, du vin et du boursin. It was an attempt to sell French cheese by saying, some bread, some wine, and a little bit of, certainly not the best cheese that the French have made, but hey, never mind. And that's what you do in French, is that you say, du vin. Je veux du vin. Je voudrais du vin. I would like some wine. It means of the wine. If you say, donnez-moi le vin, that means you want the lot. Give me the wine. But du vin means a little bit of it. You can have some too. And in Greek, it's just the same. So you'd expect this verse to say, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for of righteousness. Doesn't say that. It uses a completely different case. And what it means is, blessed are those who hunger for righteousness. The lot. They don't want a little bit of it. They don't want to see righteousness just in a few places. They want the whole of the earth, the whole of creation, to be reconciled in Christ and brought back to the beauty that God designed it for in the first place. It's not enough to hunger and thirst for a bit of righteousness. And we need to take that on board, don't we? Because sometimes we're concerned about our own internal state and living righteously inside me, not too concerned about righteousness in Yemen, South Sudan, righteousness to Muslims, righteousness to gays who may be considering suicide, all sorts of things. And righteousness can't be selective. It can't be just a bit. The number of Christians, for instance, in Germany in the 1930s, who are preaching wonderful, stirring sermons about personal righteousness and the need to be right with God, while things were going on in their society which were completely unrighteous, needs to teach us something as Christians a few years later down the line. So, let me talk about three areas in which we need righteousness. One is righteousness in my private world. This guy wrote a book once called Ordering Your Private World. His name was Gordon MacDonald. He was the pastor of a mega church in Lexington, Massachusetts. And by the time he wrote that book, I think he was being headhunted as president of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship in America. And while he was in that role, he was one of the best-known authors in the world, I guess, because his book got on the New York Times bestseller list. It was a book that Christians all over the place were reading because it was about how you sort out the mess that's going on in your head and bring it to the obedience of Jesus Christ. Do you know what? A couple of years later, he had to write another book called Rebuilding Your Broken World. And it was a much more humble book. Because in those 2 years, he had fallen into adultery himself. And he hadn't confessed it at first. He thought it would just stay secret and he could get over it and carry on. But in the end, anonymous letters started circulating. People knew more about it. And he resigned his roles and his posts. And he got back into Christian ministry after 2 or 3 years after that. But he was as a much more chastened individual. And I've got a book of his here. Another one, which is called Restoring Your Spiritual Passion. And that was written about the time when that affair was just coming to an end. So he was writing this knowing that he was a Christian and in rebellion against God. And this book has helped many people. But it was written by somebody who was in a real mess himself. And he says in the book that it's too easy to run on empty. We've all seen the car out of petrol in a long tunnel or on a narrow bridge at rush hour. Thousands of people are potentially affected in the clogged up mess that follows. And it can happen in spiritual life also. One empty spiritual tank can affect a score of other people. It's happened more than once. And he says, like many others, and he's obviously talking about the experience he's just coming out of, I am no stranger to the dried out condition. This condition is often a danger for the multi-gifted person, one who has many different gifts and capacities and who can appear to go on for long periods winging it. Those with natural talents are quite vulnerable here. They can mistake the applause of the admiring crowds for God's blessing. Often the system seems to work for a long time and then disaster. And he wrote that just as disaster was about to come on his own ministry and his own life. And it tells us something, doesn't it? None of us are proof against the empty tank syndrome, the inner mess syndrome, where we stop listening to God, stop hungering and thirsting for righteousness in our own personal lives, and start living with things that we shouldn't be living with, thinking nobody's ever going to find out, it's just me. But it's madness. It doesn't work. Righteousness too in my dealings with others. I don't know if you picked up on the story this week, but the story that's reported here is quite an interesting one. As the hurricane Dorian moved across various parts of the Caribbean, Donald Trump made a statement that people in Alabama had better look out because the tail end of it might just hit Alabama. Now that was nonsense. He just misread a document. And the U.S. Weather Service corrected it within 20 minutes, went online and said, actually, if you're in Alabama, don't worry, the president's got that wrong. Wrong? Trump is never wrong. And so over the last week, there's been a massive campaign mounted to prove that Trump was actually right. Documents have been changed. People have been threatened with losing their jobs if they don't back up his statements. All sorts of things have been going on. But in the meantime, some White House correspondents have worked out what was going on, and they've issued stories about it. So Trump sent out this tweet on September the 2nd. Such a funny hurricane report by lightweight reporter Jonathan Carl of ABC World News. I suggested yesterday at FEMA that along with Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina, even Alabama could possibly come into play, which was true. Yes, really. They made a big deal about this. Well, the interesting thing about that tweet is that Trump got the name wrong. Jonathan Carl with a K is the White House correspondent who really gets on Trump's nerves. Jonathan Carl with a C is this guy. And Jonathan Carl with a C is the Southern Baptist minister of South Fork Baptist Church in Hodgenville, Kentucky, which is a little place out in the sticks that nobody's ever heard of. And he's a nice guy. This is his Facebook page. He's got a wife and four kids, of whom he's very proud. And when this tweet came out, one of his friends drew his attention to it, he just laughed because, anybody can make a mistake. And then the hate mail started arriving. And he got a torrent of vitriol and abuse from people who, just as a knee-jerk reaction, whenever the president says, go get him, go get him. And so he got all sorts of tweets like this one. You aren't a meteorologist, you're a racist, expletive deleted. Stick with what you know, which is nothing. And that's just one of the milder ones. He got hundreds of those things. And so in the end, he wrote an open letter to the president. Dear Mr. President, I'm a casualty of your drive-by tweeting war. We all are. And here's the whole thing. It's on the internet if you want to get hold of it. He says things like this. I'm not going to read the whole thing, don't worry. I'm not mad at you, I'm sad for you. My first reaction was to laugh out loud at your mistake when I saw your tweet. My second response was sadness and compassion for you. Our words overflow from our hearts and can quickly evidence the health or sickness of our souls. Your heart must be in a dangerous place to have such a consistent flow of defamation and disrespect towards so many. He says, be slow to tweet. Please don't make the Twitter universe such a dark and depressing place. It shouldn't be a place to argue, fight, or jockey for position. We can disagree and debate without childish name-calling. You can make Twitter a better place if you choose a platform of love instead of hate. And he goes on, be humble. You called an experienced reporter a lightweight. Let's be honest, you're a lightweight too. We all are. God is the only heavyweight who knows it all and gets it right all the time. That should keep things in perspective for all of us. You're not the ultimate commander-in-chief. May we be all reminded of our national motto, in God we trust. And he ends, let's keep things in perspective. At the end of the day, being right or wrong on social media regarding the prediction of a catastrophic weather event like Hurricane Dorian isn't the main issue. Thousands of souls are suffering, and they need our prayers, encouragement, and support. We need good leaders. Please lead us well. Sincerely, Jonathan Carl, a lightweight husband, father, pastor, and latest Trump tweet casualty. I think that's great. As an example of meekness and righteousness in perfect balance, I don't think I could have had a better example to draw from this week. But righteousness, as far as others is concerned, means being prepared to tell other people what they need to hear. And sometimes that means giving them the good news as well. And we shrink from that because we're living in a world that's hostile to the gospel. But as Charles Spurgeon said in the 19th century, have you no wish for others to be saved? Then you are not saved yourself. Be sure of that. And where is that urge inside us to see other people discovering what we've got, coming into the reality, the wealth, the treasure of a relationship with Jesus? If that's not there in you, ask yourself serious questions. Righteousness with other people. Then finally, righteousness in the whole world I can affect. And then I'm finished, honestly. Righteousness in the whole world I can affect. What are we talking about here? Well, we're talking about the fact that the Old Testament prophets spoke about righteousness, not just as a personal thing, but a social thing. Something that's supposed to affect the whole of society. Micah, what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and love mercy and walk humbly with your God. Amos, away with the noise of your song, says God. I will not listen to the music of your hearts, but let justice roll on like a river and righteousness like a never-failing stream. Isaiah 58, is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen? To loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke. Is it not to share your food with the hungry, to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? When you see the naked, to clothe them and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood. Then your light will break forth like the dawn. Your healing will quickly appear. Your righteousness will go forth before you. And the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Righteousness all over the place, hungering and thirsting for it. Not just a bit of it, but all that God wants. Jesus says, if you're like that,